bought all the store's peanut butter, all its milk, and orange juice and fruit and bread. She bought a thermos and filled it with coffee, loaded the groceries into the passenger seat, climbed back into the chateau, and started the engine. Standing under the green-white light of the station, the teenager said something to her, but she couldn't hear it. She cupped her hand to her ear, smiling, hoping that would be the end of it, but instead, he jogged around to her window. "Enjoy the dawn," he said. The way he said it sounded like a statement of common inclination, that the two of them were united in preferring these small hours to be alone and apart. "Right," she said. Chapter 18. At sunrise, there was a sign, Peterson Silver Mine, 2 miles. They'd been driving for 5.5 hours, going north and northwest, and staying off the main roads. 12 times, she'd hit dead ends and closed roads and had turned around, the state seeming determined not to allow her to travel in any direct path. The night finally eased, giving way to gray light. Josie was determined to find an obscure place to park, to hide the chateau and herself. What she was looking for, really, was a cave, but she knew this was too much to ask. A mine seemed a close approximation. "You guys interested in an old silver mine?" she yelled back to the kids. They'd been asleep all night and only now were making noises implying they were waking up. Neither said anything. "You still asleep?" she asked.
"No," Anna said.
"Let's go to a silver mine," Josie said. She was slap happy, jittery from the coffee she'd bought from the last gas station and had drunk hot, then warm, then cool, then cold. A vague memory came to her of her parents taking her to a mine in Oregon. All day she'd caught them kissing in the dark tunnels. She missed the mine exit the first time, turned around and missed it from the other side. The turnoff was impossibly narrow and the sign was small and painted on wood. The chateau rumbled over the dirt road as it turned and climbed into a deep valley. "No one else here," Josie noted as they made their way 2, 3, 4 miles down the dirt road, seeing no sign of human habitation. She'd spent the night thinking to herself and muttering to herself, and now, with the children ostensibly awake, she could talk out loud and consider it sane. "Look at this," she said, "a river. Pretty." If the man followed her again, intending to serve her anything, she felt capable of fleeing or doing him harm. If they were alone, she was afraid of what she would do to him. She thought of rocks upside his fleshy head, leaving him alone and bleeding in some remote pullout. She mused over the word mine. What a funny word for the extraction of precious metals from the earth. Mine. She thought she would tell her kids her thoughts on this, the very funny confluence of the meanings of mine and mine, and then found herself whispering the words, "mine, mine, mine," and noticed she was smiling. She was far gone. "I need to sleep," she said aloud. The chateau crossed a narrow steel bridge over a clear, shallow river, and soon there was another sign telling them that the mine was 3 miles ahead. Time and space were bending. They were farther away now than when they left the highway. The landscape was lush with pine and wildflowers, and Josie was about to note this by yelling, "Pretty!" into the back when she turned to find Paul's face between the 2 front seats, alarmingly close to hers.
"Pretty," she said to him, whispered to him.
Finally, they saw a series of slapdash buildings of gray wood and rusted roofs climbing the steep hillside. There was a gate ahead, but it was closed and locked. She parked the chateau and stepped down, heading to the gate, on which there was a handwritten sign. "Closed due to government shutdown. Not our fault." Josie got back into the chateau, told the kids the park was closed, and then informed them that they would go in and walk around anyway. An idea was forming in her mind.
"Can we?" Paul asked.
"Sure," Josie said. Anna was delighted.
Josie parked directly in front of the gate so as to announce to any ranger that might appear that she was not trying to hide from authorities. To them, she wanted to appear to be a mother who had stopped momentarily to show her kids around the old silver mine. They walked around the gate and through the parking lot and saw that there was a bathroom, a tidy one with a newly shingled roof. Paul ran to it and found the doors locked. In seconds, he was peeing behind the building. The mine had been well preserved in that the park rangers and historians who had been caring for it were allowing it to decompose without much interference. Rusty machinery lay everywhere as if dropped from a passing plane. There were informative signs along a path that led visitors up to the smelting building and past the rooming houses and the old offices where the mining company kept their accountants and bookkeepers. The kids were not intrigued. Josie often had no clue what would interest them. There had been a seafaring museum somewhere last year that Anna had gone mad for, and Paul was at least politely engaged in anything, but this mining operation held no appeal. One of the signs indicated there was a river somewhere nearby, but Josie couldn't see it or hear it. They followed the path to its end, to a pair of buildings where the silver had been processed. Then, just beyond it, off the path and amid a small pocket of dense foliage, she saw a newer, tidier structure. "Wait here," she told the kids, and they sighed elaborately. They were standing in the low sun, and Josie winced while looking at their red and sweating faces. "Just need to look at this house here," she said. She climbed over the low, period-appropriate fence, rough-hewn and gray, and walked along a winding red dirt path until she reached the cottage. It was a pretty little thing, a log cabin, newly lacquered and with a cherry tint to it. She peered in the windows. It was finished nicely inside, with a fireplace, two rocking chairs, a futon, a small and plain but tidy kitchen. And it was empty. There was no indication anyone had been there for weeks, and whoever lived there last had cleaned it well before leaving. It was probably the caretaker's house, the ranger's residence, and the shutdown had apparently sent the ranger home, to some other home. Josie returned to her children. Her idea was now complete. "Why don't you guys go back to the chateau for a second?" she said. "Get something to drink. I want to look around some more." Paul and Anna did not seem enthusiastic about moving anywhere, but when Josie presented them the key to the chateau, they couldn't pass up the opportunity to unlock the door themselves. They would not get drinks or rest, she knew. They would play at locking and unlocking the door until she returned. When they had run down the path and were out of sight, Josie went back to the cabin. She tried the front door and found it locked. She went to the back, and it was shut too. She'd figured this, so then did what she'd planned to do, which was to walk back and forth along the back and side, looking for the smallest window. The smallest window was in the kitchen, a grid of 6 panes. Josie took an elephant leaf from a nearby tree, wrapped it around her fist, and punched the glass. It did not break. Her hand ached with the heat of 100 suns. She dropped to one knee, cradling her fingers, cursing herself. In a few minutes, she had recovered and searched for a rock. She found a sharp one of about 5 pounds and rapped it forcefully against the glass. Again, the window did not break. She backed up, threw the rock underhand at the glass, and missed, striking the side of the house. Finally, she picked the rock up, held it overhead, and rammed it into the window. Now the glass gave way. She waited, listening for any reaction from her children or anyone who might secretly be dwelling inside the cottage. Hearing nothing, she threw the rock away and went back to find her children. They were playing with the key and the chateau lock. Anna had cajoled Paul into being inside the RV while she was outside, trying to make the key fit. "Knock, knock," Anna said. "You have the key," Paul said from within. "Why are you knocking?" When Anna noticed Josie behind her, she looked momentarily crazy with alarm and guilt. "Come with me," Josie said, and Anna relaxed. I have something interesting to show you. A very good thing about her children at this age. Whenever she said she would show them something interesting, they invariably believed her. They always thought she would actually show them something interesting. They dutifully followed her back up the sunlit trail to its end. This time, she let them climb the fence, too, and she led them to the back of the cabin. "What do you see?" she asked. "Broken window," Paul said. "What do you think we should do?" she asked. The two children stared at her. "What would happen if this was left open, this window, in a forest like this?" she asked. "Animals," Anna said. "They'd get inside," Paul added. Josie had a plan, but wanted her children to believe it was theirs.
"Right," Josie said. "So what should we do?"
"We should tape it shut or something," Paul said.
"But how?"
Josie said. In that moment, she observed herself critically, using the Socratic method on her kids in the hopes that they would suggest that Anna crawl through the broken window.
"One of us could crawl through and find a key," Paul said.
They were wonderful people, her children. Then she thought, exactly how many misdemeanors would her family commit in this unassuming state?
"Or just open the door from the inside," Josie suggested with a noncommittal shrug.
Paul and Anna took the bait and set out on the path, seeming very serious about the task before them. After arriving at the broken window and allowing Paul and Anna to inspect it with the authority of glass repair contractors, Josie relocated the cottage's welcome mat to the windowsill and draped it over the broken window's lower ledge. Then she suggested, with all the moral seriousness of the naming of a saint, that Anna was the only human alive that could successfully make it through such a small gap, crawl down to the table below, then to the floor, then to the front door, to open it for her mother and brother.
Anna blinked hard. She couldn't believe it.
The old, restless soul in her seemed to know exactly what Josie was up to, but the actual 5-year-old, sharing Anna's corporeal form, was alive to the adventure of it all and chose to ignore the voice within her that knew better. Josie lifted her, Paul's hands ready below, and Anna's stomach shifted back and forth like a beached shark across the welcome mat. Then, in an electrifying bit of improvisation, Anna did a front somersault. Slow motion, never airborne, to get to the kitchen table below the window. Anna stood on the table for a moment, pretending to be assessing but actually just preening, knowing she was being watched and admired. Then, without fanfare, she jumped to the floor and ran to the front door, as if she'd lived in that cottage all her life. By the time Josie and Paul arrived at the door, Anna had opened it and was tapping an imaginary watch on her tiny wrist. Then she relaxed and smiled, like a host who had chosen to forgive tardy guests in the interest of preserving the mood.
"Welcome," she said.
Josie explained to them that they would need to tape the window shut from the inside. Only from the inside would it work or hold through the rains and winds. So they went into the cottage, smelling its raw woods, the faint scents of mildew and detergent, of attempted order, and they looked for duct tape and cardboard. Soon they had found both and had repaired the window, or at least made it impenetrable to insects and small mammals. But Josie's intention was not only to fix the window, but to stay here, at least until she'd decided on a next step. The location could scarcely be better. She rifled through the drawers in the kitchen until she found a key, tried it in the front door. It worked. She had a key to the cabin.
"I think we should stay here tonight," she said casually, "just to make sure the place is safe and our window repair holds."
Paul and Anna agreed, or just shrugged. They didn't care. There was no longer any logical pattern to their lives.
"Hold on a sec," she said.
Leaving the kids in the cabin, Josie jogged down to the chateau and pondered exactly what to do with the vehicle. She couldn't leave it at the gate. She looked around and saw, inside the gate and across the parking lot, a prefab garage made of corrugated steel, its door open. She expected it to be filled with vehicles or whatever else the park rangers might make use of, but it was largely empty. The shutdown, This was where the ranger had parked his truck, and now he was gone. It looked tall enough to hold the chateau. Josie examined the lock at the end of the chain. It was a standard padlock that held together the heavy chain threaded through the gate and post. Her first thought was to attack the lock itself with one of the wrenches she'd seen in the chateau tool bag. She had a jack there, too, but assumed that the padlock was designed to withstand the blows of simple steel and iron implements. She stood in the lace-white light of the morning, staring at the gate, and when she thought of a solution, she laughed. It was ridiculous, and it would work, and once she had done it, she would laugh about it always in the years to come, the ease of the gambit, the fact that they had really done it. It was a criminal act, something between breaking and entering and simple vandalism, but it would work beautifully. In minutes, she was back at the cottage and had found the saw hanging over the mantel. And then she was running down the path again, the saw held over her head with two hands. She returned to the gate and began sawing the post. She started very low, so that when she returned the post to its position, the grass growing around its base might hide the fact that she'd cut through it. Working without rest, for she worried that at any moment her kids would be upon her, witnessing this, her most bizarre and criminal act yet, she sawed through. The lock was still attached, of course, but it was now attached to a post that was unattached, that swung with the open gate. She drove the chateau through the gate and slowly guided it into the prefab garage, expecting the top to scrape any moment. It fit, though, was meant to fit, so she drove it in and closed the doors to the garage when she was finished. The chateau was invisible. She took a few $100 from the velvet bag, shoved it deep into the corner of the cabinet, afraid to count what was left, and locked the chateau door. She returned to the gate for the best part of it all. She replaced the post atop its foundation, balancing it such that it still looked like a functioning, unaltered pillar. If anyone touched it, or if a strong wind came, it would come apart, but for the time being, it looked legitimate, unaltered. They were likely free from any possibility of being found, at least for a day or two. Whatever park rangers were left in Alaska were occupied with the fires, or were far away, out of state even, enjoying fine weather on a shutdown holiday. Josie and the children inspected the cabin, the children immediately finding the stairs and running up to the pitched roof attic. "Not much up there," Paul said upon returning. "Two small beds, but it smells." Most of the cabin's life was on the main floor, with the fireplace determining the location of all other objects in the room. The futon and chairs were pointed toward the hearth, and most of the decorations surrounded it. On the mantel, a variety of fishing memorabilia, a horse carved from wood, a beaver rendered in a slab of bark. Crossed over the mantel, like swords, were a pair of wooden snowshoes, and over them, an ancient spear. To the left of the fireplace, the wall was covered with firewood. In the kitchen, there were two old stoves, neither of them functional, and a formica table, three chrome chairs around it, each with a yellow plastic seat, somewhere ripped and duct-taped. There was a sink, but no running water. Instead, there was a water bubbler, almost full. A functioning refrigerator sat low in a corner, and next to it, drawers with aluminum foil, Tupperware containers, duct tape, scissors, and string. A platoon of knives was magnetically attached to the wall, all facing right with soldierly anticipation. A small cabinet over the stove was stocked with canned soup and vegetables. Between the food they had in the chateau and this, Josie thought, they could get by for a while. "Look," Anna said. In the main room, the kids had found a stash of games, all of them 40 years old, maybe more. Scrabble, Parcheesi, two decks of cards, Sorry. Josie half expected to see Candyland and have a brief spiral of stabbing thoughts, but when she scanned the stack, she didn't see it. Then Paul did. It was under the shelf holding the rest of the games. "I've heard of this," he said, brushing the dust from the box. How come we never had this game, Mom?
Who wants to make a fire? Josie asked.
Paul and Anna delighted in choosing the right newspapers, kindling, and logs, and in minutes there was a thundering fire. At the earliest opportunity, she planned to throw the game into it, but for now she had distracted her children enough to hide it above the fridge. In the kitchen, she found a transistor radio, turned it on, and looked for news. Could there be some search going on for her? Some news of the death or maiming of a process server at the hands of diner vigilantes? She could only muster a faint signal, an evangelical message, telling listeners that God wanted them to prosper not just spiritually, but materially.
Prosper is a word rooted in the three-dimensional world, the man said.
On the counter, there was a photo of the man she assumed was the ranger who usually occupied the cabin. He was about 40, cheerful-seeming, with a red beard and wearing green and khaki. He had his arm around another man, also bearded, with the same cheerful eyes. A brother, maybe. A lover. A husband. In any case, she was contented to know the ranger who lived there, a man in love or capable of love, seemed less likely to chase them than the owner of the last cottage where they'd squatted.
I have to sleep, Josie said. She hadn't rested in more than a day.
Josie demonstrated the futon to the kids, and she could see their minds assessing whether or not they could all fit on it. She was sure they wouldn't want to sleep in the dark and drafty attic. She descended onto the padding, provoking a small cloud of dust. She did not care. Sleep pulled her down.
Are we living here now? Anna asked.
Josie fell asleep, thinking it a very real possibility. Chapter 19. In the afternoon, having slept through the day, Josie felt reborn. She raised herself from the futon, feeling unaccountably strong, and noticed that her children were nowhere in sight. She called to them. No answer. She leapt up, her heart in her mouth. She pictured a pair of wolves carrying them off. She yelled their names.
Out here, Paul said.
She threw open the door to find Paul and Anna outside on the gravel walkway, huddled around a black mass of fur.
What is that? Josie roared.
The fur shook and whimpered.
It's a dog,
Anna said, and took its face in her hands and turned it toward Josie as if to demonstrate the nature of the species to her unknowing mother.
It was scratching at the door, Paul said.
They'd opened the door, and the dog had quickly slipped inside.
We didn't want to wake you up, so we brought her out here, Paul said.
He was telling the truth. He was frighteningly considerate. But whose animal was this?
Does he have a collar? She asked.
Just this, Anna said, and pulled a plastic flea collar from its neck.
Anna had moved to the side, revealing the full shape of the dog. It was tiny and black, and looked like a malnourished pig with short hair and triangular ears.
It's shivering, Josie noted.
She's hungry, Paul said.
Keep your hands away from its mouth, Josie said.
Her mouth, Paul said. It's a girl.
If you get bitten, you'll be in the hospital for days, Josie said, and we're not near any hospitals.
Can we feed her? Paul asked.
Did you name her yet? Josie asked.
Anna did, Paul said. Follow, she said.
That's her name, Follow, Paul clarified.
Because she followed us, Anna said.
Last year she named a fish Water Lover.
I thought you said she scratched at the door, Josie said.
Paul had a way, when caught, even in the whitest of lies, of staring at Josie, unblinking, for a few long seconds before he spoke. It was not done out of any sense of strategy. It was more that he was seized by, inhabited by, a kind of truth spirit that insisted upon full revelation. He took a deep breath and began.
We went outside, just to get some sticks, he said,
indicating a small pile of sticks that, with orange duct tape, they'd made into swords.
When we were walking back, she started following us.
We closed the door and she started scratching on it. Paul exhaled in a quick burst, as if in punctuation and relief. He was happy to have gotten through it, the unadulterated truth. His posture relaxed, and he allowed himself to blink. "Can we feed it?" he asked again. So they had a dog. They brought Falo inside and fed her old fried chicken and salad, and she devoured it. Josie knew what a bad idea it was to feed a stray like this, but the animal seemed traumatized, unable to stop shivering. She conjured a narrative whereby she was the ranger's dog but had run away, and the ranger, unable to find her, had left without her. Then she'd returned to find him gone, the door locked, and her tiny self surrounded by a murderer's row of higher carnivores only too happy to lunch on her vibrating flesh. Somehow, she'd survived the days since, but was a wreck of nerves and was starving to boot. Josie examined the dog, looking for cuts or fleas or some sign of disease, and found her to be startlingly clean for a dog that had been out in the wild for days or weeks. "You can pet her," she told her children, and she sat on the futon, watching them fawn over Falo as the dog shook and ate, and shortly after eating, fell fast asleep. They continued to pet her black fur as she slept, as she breathed unevenly, her hind legs periodically jabbing at the floor. Josie had the feeling that with Falo, they had become some kind of frontier family. They broke windows and altered gates. They took in strays, and they hadn't even been in the cabin one night. The kids would not leave Falo, so they stayed inside as the night came on, and Josie built a fire, and the winds outside whistled an eerie tune. The cardboard they'd taped over the kitchen window inhaled and exhaled, but held. She brought her children with her under the covers, and they slept through the night, Paul's arm hanging to the floor where he could be sure of Falo's well-being. A ringing woke her. It was still dark, the fire weak. Who could be calling? She hadn't even seen a phone. She slipped out of bed into the kitchen, hoping the kids would sleep through it. In the dark, she swept her hands over the counter and finally, under a pile of maps, found a landline. It was still ringing. Three rings, four, each one rattling the cabin. She couldn't pick it up. Finally, after six rings, it ended. Paul and Anna were still asleep, but Josie knew she would be awake for hours. She brought a chair out to the deck and sat, jittery, listening to the night, running through possibilities. She wanted to believe the phone call was random or simply intended for the ranger who lived there. But then there was the possibility that it was Falo's owners, or the process server, or the police. "No one is looking for us," she told herself. She even manufactured a scoff, meant to put herself at ease.
"Mom?"
It was Anna, alone on the porch. Josie couldn't remember Anna ever getting out of bed alone. Usually, when she was out of bed after hours, it was part of a scheme Paul had conceived, a dual attack meant to prove that sleep was impossible for all in the house. Really, though, it meant that Paul hadn't been able to sleep, had woken up Anna and brought her with him. Only Paul was burdened with the near-death implications of sleep and the night's invitation to consider mortality and insignificance. Anna was too young to have come to these places. She was standing in the doorway, her mass of red hair matted on one side, misshapen, and a faded shade of orange, like the last pumpkin chosen from the patch. Her hands were stuck to either side of the doorframe, as if she were holding the two sides at bay.
"Are we staying here tomorrow?"
she asked.
"I think so, maybe for a few days," Josie said. "Really?"
Anna said, and her face and shoulders dropped in one beautifully coordinated collapse. Anna had similar sentiments last winter when they were headed back to school after holiday break.
"Do I go to school this week?"
she had asked.
"Yes,"
Josie had said.
"And the week after that?"
"Of course." Anna had been astonished. Winter break had brought something different each day, and now going back to school, where things did not vary so much day to day, offended her. The repetitive nature of the system assaulted her sense of the heroic possibilities of a day.
"Go to bed," Josie said. But instead, Anna came and crawled on her lap and pretended to suck her thumb.
"Don't worry, Josie," Anna said. "I won't tell Paul."
Now she gave Josie one of her looks, a conspiratorial look that said they could drop all the formalities and role-playing, the silly game of parent and child.
"I don't like you calling me Josie," Josie said.
"Okay, Mom,"
Anna said, making the words sound absurd.
"Go to bed," Josie said, pushing Anna off her lap.
Anna fell to the rough porch in a heavy, theatrical heap. She crawled back into the house, and though Josie expected to hear from her again, after 10 minutes, there was no sign that Anna was awake, which meant, for Anna, who usually fell asleep in seconds and stayed that way till morning, that she was actually asleep. As if in protest at losing Anna for the dark hours, the howl of a coyote spiraled through the night. The ringing again. Josie opened her eyes, saw that her children were already awake, huddled around Falo as she ate beef jerky, her tiny jaws snapping.
"Who's calling, Mom?" Paul asked.
"Wrong number," she said.
Josie realized that the presence of a dog did not help their situation. They wanted to be invisible, but wasn't there a chance Falo's owners would return for her? She had the thought that perhaps Falo belonged to someone else nearby, and that like many a puppy, she had simply been exploring when she encountered Paul and Anna and followed them to the cabin door. There was a chance the owners knew the ranger, that the dog had come here before, and they were calling to check if he'd seen her. Or there was the possibility that it was simply a telephone, that people made calls, that it rang, and none of it had anything to do with Josie and her children. She could unplug the phone. But what if the ranger called, found out it had been disconnected? She had to leave it be.
"Let's go for a walk," she said,
not telling Paul and Anna that she thought there was at least some chance that Falo would lead them to her actual owner and real home. And so Josie packed a backpack with crackers and water from the bubbler. They tied a rope to Falo's flea collar and made their way up through the mine and into the woods beyond. The animal was tentative still, walking ahead, then circling back to the children, then running ahead for a spell before coming back again. She was either a deeply troubled dog or not very bright. When they reached a stand of birch trees, though, some sense of purpose seized the dog, and she led them down a steady slope until they heard the sound of rushing water. Falo brought them to a narrow stream cut through a tight valley and drank deeply from the rushing water.
"Mom?" Paul said.
"Where do languages come from?" He wanted to know why there was Italian and Hindi and Swahili and not just English, and why they spoke English, and was English the best language? Josie made a brief stab at the origin of languages, the vicissitudes of distance and isolation in the formation of foreign tongues. People living far from anyone else, she explained, as they were, might be the sorts of people who created their own tongue. They could, she said, create their own words for anything. And to demonstrate, she held up a rock in the shape of a man's head. "I could call this kind of rock Tapatoc, for example," she said. "And from then on, all the people who came after us would call it Tapatoc." Anna picked up a rounder rock.
"I call this Dad."
"Dad is already a word," Paul said. "And why would you call that Dad?" His mood darkened, and Anna took note. Paul went down to the water to pet Falo, taking her into his tiny lap. Anna followed, then was distracted by something else, her head tilted. She took a few steps forward, stepping into a grassy bouquet of wildflowers, dropped the rock, and pointed up.
"Waterfall."
There, cut through the cliffside above them, was a narrow white plume falling from 50 feet above. They all wordlessly agreed to walk to the waterfall. When they got close, the volume was far greater than it had seemed from the path. For a moment, the falling water seemed utterly sentient, falling with joyous aggression to the earth, spitefully suicidal. The spray reached them first, and they stopped, sat, and watched the waterfall's ghostly white fingers. In the wall of mist, rainbows shot off like birds taking flight. Follo kept her distance. Josie strode to the waterfall, stepping on the wet stones, trying to find a way not to soak herself, and when she was close enough, she put her hand under the flow, feeling its strength and its numbing cold. "Can we drink it?" Paul asked. Josie's instinct was to say no, of course not, but already the woods had calmed her, opened her, so she did something that she wanted to do but normally would not have done. She took their thermos out of the backpack, emptied it, and then held it under the rush. Immediately her hand was soaked, her arm was wet to the shoulder, and the bottle was full. She turned to Paul and Anna, seeing their astounded faces, and raised the bottle to the sun and sky to see if it was clear. Josie and her children saw the same thing, that the water was perfectly transparent. There were no particles, no sand, no dirt, nothing. Josie brought it to her lips, and Paul took a quick intake of breath. "Is it good?" Paul asked. "It's good," she said, and gave it to him. He took a sip and smacked his lips. He nodded and handed it to Anna, who drank without caution. After she took her fill, Paul asked, "Are we the first to drink from this?" He meant the waterfall, but Josie took some liberty with her interpretation. This water, flowing at this moment? Yes, they were the first. The days were like this. Each was miles long and had no aim or no possibility of regret. They ate when they were hungry and slept when they were tired, and they had nowhere to be. Every few days, Anna would ask, "Are we living here?" or "Are we going to school here?" But otherwise, both children seemed to sense their time in the cabin was a kind of respite, apart from any calendar, that there was no inevitable end. In the mornings, Paul and Anna drew and played board games and cards, and near noon they walked to the waterfall to splash in the shallow water. They were in the woods now, and the woods were unbreakable. Anna acted nobly, and her face shone with an otherworldly glow. Children, Josie realized, are truly like animals. Give them clean foods and water and fresh air, and their coats will be shiny, their teeth white, their muscles supple and skin bright. But indoors, contained, they will become mangy, yellow-eyed, riddled with self-inflicted wounds. In those long days at the Peterson mine, Paul and Anna made bows from bent sticks and rubber bands. They created and destroyed dams in the river. They piled rocks to make walls and rock castles. They read by candlelight. Josie taught Paul how to start a fire in the hearth. They napped some afternoons, and other afternoons they explored the buildings of the old mine, the midday sun coming through the porous roofs in white bolts, dozens of tiny spotlights illuminating dust and rust and tools not held for 100 years. There were 100 uncomplicated hours in every day, and they didn't see a soul for weeks. Was it weeks? They no longer had a grasp of the calendar. During the day, all was quiet, but for the occasional scream of a bird, like a lunatic neighbor. At night, the air was alive with frogs and crickets and coyotes. Paul and Anna slept deeply, and Josie hovered over them like a cold night cloud over rows of hills warmed all day in the sun. They were growing in beautiful ways, becoming independent and forgetting all material concerns, were awake to the light and the land, caring more about the movement of the river than any buyable object or piece of school gossip. She was proud of them, of their purifying souls, the way they asked nothing of her now. They slept through the night and relished the performing of chores, liked to wash their clothes, and they were immeasurably better now than they were in Ohio. They were stronger, smarter, more moral, ethical, logical, considerate, and brave, and this was, Josie realized, what she wanted most of all from her children. She wanted them to be brave. She knew they would be kind. Paul was born that way, and he would make sure Anna was kind. But to be brave. Anna was inherently courageous, but Paul was learning this. He was no longer afraid of the dark, would plunge into any woods with or without a light. One day, on her way back from the woods, she caught the two of them on the hillside near the cabin, both barefoot, gently shushing through the shallow leaves with their bows, watching something invisible to her. She turned, scanned the forest, and finally saw it, a 10-point buck walking through the birches, his back straight and proud. Her children were mirroring it on the other side of the hill, unheard by the deer. They had turned into something else entirely. All along, she had been looking for courage and purity in the people of Alaska. She had not thought that she could simply, not simply, no, but still, create such people. But the food ran out, one staple at a time. First they were out of milk, then juice, and were drinking only water, first from the bubbler, then from the waterfall. They went through the vegetables, then the apples, and finally the potatoes. They lived on nuts, crackers, and water for 2 days before a trip into town was unavoidable. "We'll go tomorrow," Josie said.
"I don't want to go anywhere," Anna said.
The thought of driving the chateau again and exposing herself to the road, to the prospect of meeting anyone who might still be pursuing her family, filled her with a crippling dread. To reduce the risk, she went out to the garage with a screwdriver, planning to remove the license plates. She was halfway there when she heard Paul calling. "A map!" he yelled as he flew down the path to her, Follo running behind. "Is this where we are?" Paul asked. He had it spread out on the ground between them. It was a dense thing, showing every foot of elevation, a maze of green lines, numbers, and jagged paths, but they found the mine on it, and finally they arrived at the exact location of the cabin. "We're here," he said. "Okay," Josie said. "There's a town over here," Paul noted, pointing to a small grid that looked to be just over a ridge, only a few miles away as the crow flies. There seemed to be a trail that went over the ridge, bringing them to the town via a frontage road. They would appear from the trail like hikers, and then disappear again like hikers, and even if anyone took note of the three of them, remembering Anna's orange tumbleweed hair, they would be able to say only that they came out of the woods, or returned to the woods. "And look," Paul said, pointing to a wide thread of blue. "A river, I think." "The Yukon," Josie said. They were at the Yukon River, or within walking distance, and all this time they'd had no idea. "Will we bring Follo?" Paul asked. They discussed leaving her alone in the cabin, which seemed unwise. She'd tear the place up. They could lock her in the bathroom, but that would be cruel. "I think we have to," Josie said, putting their fiery faces to bed. Josie sat outside, listening to the lunatic night, her bullet hole guitar on her lap. She didn't want to go to town. She had begun to think they could stay in the woods indefinitely. For the time being, she missed no one and nothing. She tried to conjure a decent chord and failed. She tried to pick a string, any string, to make a pleasing sound and got nowhere. She put the guitar down, went inside, and found Follo standing on the futon as if waiting for her company. She lifted the dog, who weighed no more than a carrot, brought her outside, and petted her until her black fur calmed and she returned to sleep. This was about the time the ringing had come before, so Josie's back was tense. The cabin door squeaked.
"Mom?"
It was Anna.
"You can't be awake," Josie said. "But I am," Anna said.
Anna came to Josie's chair and leaned against it. She was wearing her conspiratorial face, the one she wore when she called Josie by her first name. She traced circles on Josie's arm, her mouth moving, as if practicing something she needed to say.
"What is it?" Josie asked. "Mom, I know Dad's dead."
She produced an apologetic smile.
"What?"
Josie said. A flicker of doubt entered Anna's eyes.
He is, right?
No. Josie threw her arm around Anna and pulled her close.
No, sweetie,
she said into Anna's thicket of hair, smelling of wood smoke and sun and sweat. Anna pulled away.
But then where is he?
Josie put Follow gently down, lifted Anna into her lap, and gathered her little legs in so she could wrap her arms around her daughter, hold every part of her. She considered how to answer Anna's question, how to hedge or say that her father was away, or they were away, or on vacation, or people grow apart, or make some half-promise to see him soon. But Josie knew it was time to call him. She felt a sudden tenderness toward Carl, because he had helped to create this child sitting in her lap, who had begun to think that if Jeremy was gone and dead, her father, who was gone, was dead too. In the morning, in town, she would call Carl, and call Sonny, would tell everyone where she was and why, to let them know they would return. Chapter 20. It was absurd to lock a house where they were squatting, but Josie did lock it, knowing that if they returned and saw any sign of new arrivals, for example, the rightful occupants, they could probably make it to the chateau without being detected. She debated whether or not to take the velvet sack with them, but because the cabin was their home now, she felt it was safer inside than with them. She hid it behind the household cleaners under the sink. They took the trail up past the last of the mine's buildings, a shack now, with but one wall standing, stepped over the low fence, and continued. The path rose up the hill for a quarter mile before it turned and wound around another low peak, one they hadn't been able to see from the cottage. This must be Franklin Hill, Paul said, and Josie had the thrill of believing that this was possible, that they could set out in unknown territory with a handmade map, and they would see actual landmarks that bore some topographical resemblance to the map in the cabin. They rounded the hill and passed through a huddle of pines, and just like that, they could see the town below, very small, no more than a few hundred residents, most of the buildings standing by the bend in the river. The water was blue and brown and traveled slowly but shimmered boldly in the mid-morning sun. The rest of the walk, about a mile downhill, was giddy, the children galloping down the dusty path with Follow ahead of them, then behind them, circling, everyone thinking they were doing something extraordinary. Separating the trail from the town was a small RV park, a circle of vehicles surrounding a picnic area, white tables arranged in a half moon. Josie stopped, looked at her kids, hoping they had the appearance of a family returning from a short hike in the hills. Anna was wearing simple sneakers, and Paul was wearing his leather boots. Paul was carrying a school backpack, and Anna was carrying a stick in the shape of a machine gun. She had assured Josie she would not fire it. They put Follow's rope leash on her collar and emerged from the trail. The RV park was empty, but for an older couple sitting on folding chairs, staring into the sun from the opposite side of the lot. When they arrived at the town's main street, they saw that it was not a regular day in town. Mom, is this a holiday? Paul asked. Josie had to think about it for a second. Was it Labor Day? No, too late for that. But the streets had been blocked off for a parade. It was just ending, but Josie and Paul and Anna found a spot on the curbside and sat down just as a high school band, small but loud, passed by, playing some 70s soul song Josie couldn't place and which was suffering greatly. The band was followed by a group of elderly women steering riding lawnmowers. Then a convertible carrying Julie Zloza, tree farmer, teacher, who was running for state representative. Then a dozen or so kids on bikes, dressed like revolutionary soldiers. A group from the local ASPCA, hoping to entice onlookers into adopting six or seven parading dogs, two of them missing legs. The local middle school had a float, where all the school's extracurricular activities seemed to be represented, twin girls in karate outfits, a tall boy in a basketball uniform, a small boy wearing a gold medal, likely some kind of academic decathlete. Walking behind the float was a lone boy in football gear. The final parade float carried a band, 10 or 12 adults in close quarters, playing guitars and banjos and fiddles, all acoustic, sending an Americana sound into the air to the general indifference of the dissipating crowd. They followed the few hundred people in town to a park where a sign gave notice that there would be a birthday party starting in minutes for Smokey the Bear.
"Who's invited?" Anna wanted to know.
"It's not that kind of a party," Paul said.
"Can I see the invitation?" Anna asked.
When they got to the park at the foot of a small wooded hill, they found most of the residents of the town, some gathered around picnic tables, others lining up for the bouncy house in the shape of a cresting wave, complete with a trio of inflated surfers. Already there was a table set up with a large, sad sheet cake saying only "Smokey," and around the cake were various brochures about fire safety, urging celebrants to support local rangers. Anna and Paul were drawn to a fire truck where a goateed firefighter was demonstrating the use of his axe. Next to him, a woman in khaki with a high bouffant was showing the assembled kids the workings of a high-pressure fire hose. Josie thought of the strange math of the firefighting business at the moment. These two were here celebrating Smokey's birthday, all patient and nonchalant, while elsewhere in the state, a platoon of inmates were trudging off into the unknown. There was a gasp, and all heads turned. Coming down the hill behind them were a pair of women in overalls, each of them holding the hand of a giant bear in blue jeans. It was Smokey, but this Smokey had aged, had lived a sedentary life. This Smokey was walking very slowly, and he wore his pants high around his stomach. He emerged from the woods resembling an elderly man who had been in the hospital for many months and was for the first time walking in the light of day, more or less under his own power. Smokey stepped carefully in front of the audience and waved a small, tentative wave. He was not the same bear they'd been seeing on the ubiquitous television spots about fire safety. That Smokey was an insurmountable brown monument. That Smokey had intermingled with Josie's thoughts while Jim was pressing himself into her in the chateau a lifetime ago. This Smokey, standing in front of a birthday cake, no candles, and still being held steady by the two assistants, had no idea where he was. Anna and Paul grew distracted by the inflated wave. Anna asked, and Josie consented, and Paul followed his sister, relinquishing the dog's rope leash. Josie and the dog meandered across the park, then, not wanting to be in the circle of parents watching their children climb up and slide down, Josie was not ready for conversation yet. She stopped under a small pine and heard the faint sounds of live music, starting and stopping, sounding like the band from the parade. She looked around her and finally saw, in a wooded corner of the park, a circle of adults playing guitars and harmonicas. And was that an oboe? It was the same band, but now expanded to 9 or 10. Their arms were strumming furiously, their shoulders turning, and one man, the one facing her most directly, was sitting bow-legged, flapping his legs up and down like a frog to the rhythm. When he lifted his head, though, Josie ducked behind a tree, and for a while she stayed there, feeling ridiculous, given Follow was clearly visible, her leash giving her away if anyone cared to look.
"I see you,"
a voice said. Josie said nothing, did nothing.
"Behind the tree. We all see you and your pig dog. Come over."
Josie wanted to run. They didn't know her face yet. If she ran back, maybe she could return later, not as the woman behind the tree, but as a regular person. She could bring the kids.
"Come on,"
the voice said, and Josie emerged, bashful, walking over to the circle, seeing that most of the faces were looking up at her, all of them smiling with perfect openness.
"Come sit,"
the first face said. This was the voice who found her, had spoken to her. He was bearded and thin, in the realm of 40, lithe and bright-eyed, wearing a plaid shirt and a baseball cap. He indicated a place near him, but across from him. My kids are on the bouncy wave, Josie said, nodding to the giant wave balloon across the park. She sat between a blonde woman holding some kind of harpsichord and the man with the oboe. The bearded man began to play again, and the sound was bigger than before. She was in the middle of the sound, the crashing chaos of it, the diagonal violence of the strumming, the jagged strokes of the violinist, and yet the music was joyous, rollicking. What was this song? It was folksy, but had some bossa nova in there, and when she thought she knew it, a man near her, easily 70, and with a wild tangle of gray hair and gray beard, the swirl of it like an aerial view of a hurricane, began singing. In che mondo viviamo imprevedibile? Was that Italian? She did not expect Italian language to come from this man's mouth, in this remote town, in this park near the Yukon. His eyes were closed. He could sing. What did it mean? Josie assumed it was something like, in this world that we live in, incredible. Then he sang the same verse or some version of it in English, and it was not quite what she expected. In this world that we live in, unpredictable, unpredictable. In this world of sorrow, there is justice, there is beauty. A beautiful song. Far too beautiful for this park on this afternoon, far too beautiful for her. The sun was directly above, performing its intoxication, and Josie was immediately caught up and nodding her head, bouncing her feet. In che mondo viviamo imprevedibile? Josie glanced to her right to see the man playing the oboe, and when he saw her watching him, his long fingers on that long black tube, he winked. Was there ever anything more phallic and less alluring than an oboe? Across the circle, a woman was playing the violin, though in this context it was probably a fiddle. Josie watched them all, their hands shooting up and down again. These were unnatural movements. Without sound, the motions they made would look mad. These drastic gestures up and down, their chins and cheeks stuck to these wooden instruments, fingers touching strings in certain places at certain times. And suddenly the song was over, and Josie felt spent. These people didn't know what they'd just done. What they were capable of. These goddamned musicians, they never knew their power. To those with no musical talent, to Josie, what they could do sitting in a park near an inflatable wave was both miraculous and unfair. They were sitting there, adjusting strings, smiling at her, murmuring about keys and about the weather, when Josie felt like she'd just heard something absolute in its power to justify her life. Her children justified her daily breaths, her use of planetary resources, and then this, her ability to hear a song like that in a group like this. Those were the three primary justifications for her living. Surely she was forgetting other things, but what?
We're just jamming, the bearded man said.
God damn you, she wanted to say. It's more than that. It's so easy for you, so hard for the rest of us.
You have any requests?
He asked.
I'm Cooper.
Josie shook her head, now trying to shrink. She wanted just to listen, not to be part of this. She wanted to go back behind the tree, to listen unseen. Anything, she said. She grabbed at a patch of grass underneath her and pulled. Was this a crowd that would know Carousel, she wondered. Kiss Me, Kate?
Name something. I bet we know it, Cooper said.
Now most of the faces were looking at her, actually wanting a request. Maybe they were bored with one another, these spoiled magicians. Okay, Josie said, her voice sounding hoarse. There were songs Josie knew, and there were songs she knew they would know, and there were songs she knew they would want to play. So she went for the third category. This land is your land, she said, shrugging, though knowing they would love this. There was some nodding and grinning. She had made a good choice, and they began to get themselves into position. The harpsichord began, and the rest of the players followed. They went through the whole song, all 6 verses, 8 choruses, and they insisted Josie sing, too. The song seemed to last 20 minutes, an hour. She glanced at the bouncy house periodically, catching sight of Anna and Paul climbing the inflated steps, sliding down, starting over.
"You play anything?"
the oboe man asked her. She told him no, she had no aptitude at all.
"Ever try to learn?"
he asked. "So many times, Jesus Christ," Josie said, and this was true.